You're going to meet another candidate for Seattle mayor here in a few minutes on today's edition of The Record on KUOW. Bill Radke here, glad to have you along with us. Last fall, Labor Day, the eastern Washington towns of Malden and Pine City near Spokane were engulfed by what's now called the Bab Road Fire. You can see the destruction online, just drone footage of the apocalypse. 80-some percent of these towns burned and gone. Just this spring, 8 months after the fire, the federal government finally approved disaster relief. This week, Washington Congressmember Kathy McMorris Rogers announced the Malden Act meant to speed up disaster relief. And here to tell you how that would work and how the towns are doing today is Malden Town Council member Scott Hokanson. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill. Thanks to your listeners, too.
What was wrong with the way the federal government responded to your towns after the fire?
That's a great question. What was wrong, what was lacking is any response. The state and local agencies did their work. An application was made. Our governor, Jay Inslee, did his work, put the application into FEMA. FEMA did their work. Yet at an executive branch level, the decision was never made. So that left us in limbo completely. We couldn't pass go. We couldn't collect $200. We couldn't access all of the things that we desperately needed. So this act, I believe it's Making Aid for Local Disasters Equal Now, Malden Act, would save any community in the United States from having to face what we went through, which you mentioned the apocalypse. Yeah, we went through hell on earth. And then we went through almost 6 months of waiting to find out who could come and help us.
But why did that limbo happen?
That limbo happened because, and at first it was talked about behind closed doors, maybe so, maybe not. And then it became front door news that there was former President Trump didn't care for how our Governor Jay Inslee did certain things. And so, you know, if I relate it to when I tell people, imagine if your favorite family member, the person you love most on the planet, was in a car accident. You didn't know how bad they were hurt. You didn't know if their car needed attention, whether the fire needed to be put out, whether they had injuries. And what if there was no EMT that showed up? What if there was no police officer? What if you just had a bystander saying, hey, I've seen an accident like this before. Somebody should be here any minute. And we heard that for 6 months, every day, hour after hour. And our federal and our partners were baffled. No one could figure out why this was happening. No community should have to fall through the cracks like this. So in actuality, you know, to be part of the American experiment that we are in this country, this is actually good news. As bad as it was for us, if this can be addressed through congressional legislation in less than a year's time, brings a lot of closure to me and a lot of peace and a lot of catharsis. You know, this act could actually save people's lives from depression, from injury, and get help where it's needed immediately. I think it's a true success story now of answering a problem quickly and efficiently.
So it sounds like a political dispute. This act is sponsored by a Republican member of Congress from Washington, Kathy McMorris Rogers. You've worked on the proposal yourself. How would it change, just briefly, how would it change how disaster aid will work if it passes?
Yeah, so I can't thank Representative McMorris Rogers' office and CMR herself for all the work that she's done. As have our other congresswomen, we're very lucky in Washington to have strong female leadership at the congressional level. This actually would be so effective because what it would do is it puts a clock on recovery efforts when a declaration has been requested. If it's at the president's desk, he or she needs to sign that within 30 days to approve or deny. If it is not signed, it is automatically approved. And this is the big one. For rural areas, local emergency management within 15 days of the request being made, if IA, individual assistance, is denied, like we were, because we were too small for a federal response, a number of items will happen of coordination for efforts to showcase what partners can help. Religious partners, volunteer partners, national level partners, they can immediately bring in help. Where we had to cobble together our own response, anticipating again, well, any day this is going to happen, which we didn't know for 6 months. And then we just needed to start triaging and putting Band-Aids on when, you know, we don't even know the proper method. We needed the doctors to show up, essentially.
We're talking about the devastation by wildfire of the Malden Pine City area of eastern Washington last year and the long delay in federal disaster relief and a possible congressional response to that. And I'm talking with Scott Hokanson, who is a town council member in Malden, helps lead the recovery there as part of the Pine Creek Community Restoration. So, Scott, how is restoration going now? How is recovery?
I'm glad you asked that. Recovery is going very well. I'm at the nexus of a lot of information, and I'm truly humbled to be part of this because something I haven't shared much with you or with many other people is I'm a firefighter. I'm a first responder. And so I was one of the only people responding to our fire, if not the only person, until the sheriff's office showed up, because other fire department members were fighting fires many tens of miles away in other towns. And the recovery effort is going well, but to be able to, you know, respond to a fire, help people get out, and then be able to help as a town council member, and then with recovery effort, is truly a noble undertaking that I am humbled to be part of. And I'm really glad people have been able to come in and help us look towards recovery. We have a number of great things. We've been able to build two donated houses with donated time, materials, and money. We just got a commission for seven more from a group that helped us build the initial two. We also have other groups from different parts of the country who are willing to build more houses for those people who might need them most, who are in limited incomes, disabled, retired veterans, that type of thing. So our most at-need residents are actually getting the help, and we're getting some money to come in to help fund those efforts. We continue with the recovery efforts, but you know, that's been my big push, is get the people who are in RVs and temporary living situations that are substandard. They're actually considered homeless if you live in an RV for the winter in our area. So getting those people the help they need of a solid home really helps, you know, our town and our areas recover with resiliency rather than just a patchwork of a response.
You say donated houses. From our conversation before, it sounds like most of the folks there had not insured their homes.
Yeah, we're estimating about 60% were severely underinsured or not insured at all. So some do have the means to, you know, to facilitate building a home. But again, we're in a health crisis and we're in a housing crisis, and it's almost impossible to find materials for less than three times what they cost last year. So for us to be able to build two houses under those events and also have eight more coming online this year is something that, you know, my group should be extremely proud of, and anybody that has to do anything with our effort should be proud of.
Yeah, you mentioned the cost of building going up. Does that have to do with the price of lumber and the various construction and industry bottlenecks we've heard so much about?
It does entirely. Yeah, in fact, even if you're well-funded and have insurance, if you want to have a contractor come out and build a home, the waiting list might even take you to at least 2022, possibly 2023. So our recovery efforts are on more of a years type scale rather than a month's, but we're getting houses to the people who have no other option to get one and who used to own one. Some of these people are such fine individuals, and it pleases me to no end that these efforts are actually coming to fruition. Houses for people who need them, who do not have other options.
As I said, some 80-85% of Malden and Pine City, Pine City were were just wiped out. As I've seen the footage, it was just rubble, just ashen piles. And so I think you lost 120 houses. You say you've got two in and you know, a few more on the way. But do you have a town yet, Scott, in Malden?
Yes, so we still do. I mean, it's linguistically, the town and the community, their words and their ideas in people's heads. So we've been able to keep a community together by meetings, holding events in our town park. We've been able to get some great funding for events and items such as community center that bring back that idea of community. And, you know, we don't know exactly what's going to be built back again. I never know from day to day what might be offered of help, what might be withdrawn, what's possible, what's not. But by being open to partnerships and anything, keeping that idea of being as inclusive as possible, not exclusive. If anybody ever rebuilds anything, the one piece of advice I'd like to give is, it's not ordering a pizza. You can't say, I don't want this. What helps is to say, I'll take anything. We'll take a look at anything that comes our way and put that into the mix and see if we can make that work. So keeping that idea strong of community, and also people who've never heard of the area who may want to come in, who can then keep our community strong, keep it getting larger or growing or staying you know, where we have enough people involved in the voting process and volunteering and being on town council. But we're truly trying to keep the town alive too, the towns themselves, not just, you know, building houses. Now there's a number of, you know, market rate houses that have been built and brought in as well. But as far as the recovery efforts, you know, if we can get 10 this year, 20 or 30 next year, those are numbers I never thought would be possible, but they're very much becoming reality.
You're in a pretty Republican area there. Are there residents who say they don't want a government handout?
There are, but there are some who, you know, who are looking for what is the government going to do or do not want involvement. But this truly brings in the fact where, you know, sometimes when people say, well, hey, it doesn't affect anybody but me. I can do this. It's not going to hurt anybody. This fire showed us that, you know, how close your neighbor's home was to your home and whether they had burnable material close to their home impacted how much your home might burn. Your neighbor having fire resistant materials on their home of the building materials themselves predicated whether your house might burn. So we are interconnected. We are intertwined. You know, we do have a community and we do need to have not only civility, but we need to decide together, how are we going to do things? Individuality works well in some cases, but in a response to a disaster like this, or even planning for resilience in the future, standard practices and best practices really have to be decided upon by locals and then enacted by locals.
Scott Hokanson is helping lead recovery in Malden and Pine City, Washington, outside of Spokane after the devastating, beyond devastating Labor Day fires last year. How about your mental health, Scott? You and your neighbors, they were really suffering when we talked earlier. You've been so sort of logistically overwhelmed. How are you and your neighbors doing?
Yeah, thank you for asking. My neighbors have had a very tough time. You know, I know a lot of what's happening with recovery efforts, and I still don't know everything. I'm learning, but I am now hopeful. For the first time, I am truly hopeful, 98% hopeful. And that's not a sales pitch. That's honest. I think you can hear from, you know, we've had enough conversations. You've heard me down the last two conversations because we were still waiting for so many things. All the hard work and all the waiting is coming to fruition. The Malden Act is a big part of that catharsis that I mentioned. My neighbors have gone through a lot of ups and downs. I'm glad you asked because I haven't talked much about my own issues, my own, you know, dealings with the stress. And post-traumatic stress used to be a term to me. It's a real thing. I've had to seek help for it. As a firefighter and first responder, I was told, you know, after getting people out that we should expect bodies in the 20s, that we would expect casualties in that area, low 20s, maybe high 20s, depending upon. And that there could be groups of children because it happened during the day and because of the numbers that were coming back to us. We were told to expect that. People were looking, professionals were looking. And to live through that, you know, the first few weeks when we didn't know how many bodies we were going to find, who we could talk to, people were missing, scattered in every direction. The fire moved at one block every 10 seconds. That's all, 10 seconds per city block. You couldn't do anything. There was no stopping it. So we got as many people out as we could, but we didn't know if we got everybody out. Personally, for me, living with that, I really blocked that out. I even talked to, you know, friends and family, and I asked them not to, you know, I didn't want to talk about it, but I need to normalize that as much as possible. So others going through disasters, tragedies, can hear from as many people as possible, just like getting your oil changed. If you just drive on the freeway, you can get it changed every 3,000 miles, 5,000 miles. But if you go over rough, rocky road under high heat and intense pressure and really abuse it, you're going to have to get your oil changed more often in your car. No one would argue with that. Mental health is so important in this. I was told by the director of Washington State Emergency Management, he sat in my office, Robert Ezell, a fine man. And I have to thank him because he talked to me and said, Scott, the biggest thing you can do to help your community recover is take care of yourself and your mental health. You get that help. Others will get that help. Talk about it, normalize it, and less repercussions of that PTSD will ripple through the community. And I found that to be true. It's been very hard initially to talk about it, but you know, I do see things, I do hear things that in the past I would not have, and it's purely a post-traumatic stress reaction. And I need to talk about it as normally as if the sun's coming up or rain falls down. It happens after a traumatic event, we have that. And so by talking about it to others, they don't feel alone. They don't have a ripple effect from a divorce or a job loss, because you add those things onto a disaster like this, and that can mean you know, very, very bad outcomes for people and for communities, and that becomes contagious. And I do not want that to be contagious. I want the recovery, the resiliency, the future that we got everybody out alive, and we can help that. You know, we can move on forward.
Scott, we're all hoping for your recovery in many senses of the term, but here we are with wildfire season just about to crank up again. What does that mean?
Yeah, first and foremost, it means dang, right? Like a deep breath of how bad is it going to be? What might happen? What do we need to prepare for? I've talked to our construction manager that we brought onto the long-term recovery group and tasked him with finding out best practices for fire resiliency for not only rebuilding, but homes that did make it through the fire. Now with FEMA involved in our recovery, we can have some FireWise help and some other things. But I think mentally preparing for what might happen and how we can make it through, and then also how we can help and advocate for others. We had such great support at a state and local level in our recovery. People who came and sat by me like favorite aunts and uncles, who listened to me, who talked to me, who gave me advice no matter what was going on in our recovery, you know, for months when we didn't know who was coming to help. And, you know, I'd like to offer that to other communities when and if they face disaster. We've had some great support from nonprofits who have said, you know, take this Malden recovery team and help others if you have a chance, you know, give them a little bit of support if they need it until the appropriate response comes in. And that's really how I look at it. And I think others have found, you know, great comfort in that, is just like this Malden Act, it does not help what, you know, what happened to us. We can't change that. But hopefully no one else has to go through that. And through that, you know, that's a great example of what works in our country. That really does.
Scott Hokanson, Malden Town Council member, firefighter, helping lead the recovery there in Malden and Pine City as part of the Pine Creek Community Restoration. Scott, thanks for telling us about this proposal in Congress and about your town's recovery and how you're doing personally as well. We wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be on.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. We're going to come back and you'll meet yet another candidate to be mayor of Seattle. Don't go away. There are more than a dozen people running to be mayor of Seattle, and we're introducing you to them on The Record here. These are not your typical Record interviews that you would hear on our show. We're just keeping things fair here by asking every person the same series of questions, giving them about the same time to answer. So this is their chance to introduce themselves to you first in their words, and then KUOW will, of course, dig into the details as the election gets closer. This week's candidate is Bobby Tucker, and I started by asking Tucker what he loves about Seattle.
The water. I love the water. Yes, whenever I have, I'm from Texas, and whenever I leave and stay, I always miss the water. One thing I love about Seattle is that no matter which direction you go, you eventually we're wanting to run into some water, run into the water. Yeah,
that's true. Next question is, why are you running to be mayor of this watery town?
I'm running because I care. I care about people. So that would be my main reason for running, to make a difference.
And what is your top priority?
My top priority will probably be like everyone else's. Mine is definitely homelessness.
And why is that? Why is homelessness your top priority for you personally?
Personally, because I was homeless myself. I have been homeless myself before. And you know, one thing about being homeless, sometimes I'm sure you do, and when you wake up through the night, sometimes you want to, and you can't sleep, you want to go to the restroom or go watch TV or go in the kitchen and cook something or eat. And so, you know, to not have those things, it's pretty horrible experience. And not only that, the safety of having a home, you know, when you wake up, because when you homeless and sleeping in a tent or in your car, you know, you're just really vulnerable, and people have all access literally to your sleeping space. For now, we got a lot of empty buildings like schools that already have bathrooms, kitchen, and things like that. And basically, rural would be great to modify and those to get people in there. And that way, I believe once you get people, like when you want people to move from somewhere, just say an encampment, if you want to move people, you have to be like, well, you have to have somewhere to put them in order to enforce. I think in order to force them from someplace, have somewhere for them to go. And then therefore, if you house the people, then we can get caseworkers to go in because they, you know, they're approachable, that you can locate them and you know where they are and what their needs are. And, you know, you already got other communities like Rex Holden of the Block Project. You know, they got projects that work with cities, you know, to create some amazing, innovative backyard cottages for homeless people and individuals. So I would rewrite the book. I just think there are a lot of things that are already there that just need to be implemented. And so that's what I would do. And then once we got those people home or housed, you know, we can go and interview them, see what their needs are, and then, of course, get them to work. We, you know, build a relationship with employers to get these people to work.
We're introducing you to all the candidates for Seattle mayor by asking them all the same few questions, including what is your top priority. We're talking with candidate Bobby Tucker now. And the next question I'm asking all the candidates, Bobby, is what have you done that has prepared you to be mayor of Seattle?
Well, I worked on other campaigns. People who are running for mayor right now, again, I've definitely worked in their campaign, minority representative in college. So what I've done is work with other candidates and volunteer in my own experience, just living a life and survival.
I'm also asking all the candidates about division, because sometimes people say that Seattle is divided. Do you see it that way? And if you do, where's that division and where do you stand along it?
Well, Seattle is divided. I mean, I think a lot of cities, but we're talking about Seattle. I think what I see is people need to take a look at themselves. I'm a single father, and I say that because, you know, you hear that old saying that it takes a village to raise a child, and it really does. And same thing with a city. You know, if we look at ourselves and recognize and that we need one another, you know, to help one another, see one another as human being, that we need one another, not look down on one another just because some have and some don't have. You got the have and the have not. And so if we can recognize and realize and have respect for one another, because there's enough. I'm a man of God. God has made us or created us to be brilliant people. And this is not something that we cannot do. So I believe if we come together and be honest and true to one another and notice this division, all it does is make matters worse. We're separated, but united, we can stand and, you know, give help where help is needed. Some need more help than others. And that's why I kind of see us coming together, fixing this division that are here in this Seattle area.
Seattle mayoral candidate Bobby Tucker, my final question is, what are you asking of the people of Seattle? We're listening to you right now. What do you want us to do?
What I want us to do is, again, to take a look at ourselves and let us help one another. You know, it's just like when disasters come and people come together. You know, it shouldn't have to be a disaster, which it is, to come together and then everybody help each other to give everybody what everybody needs. So what I would like for us all to do is look where the need is. And if you're able to give, you know, give and come together. And if you got some great ideas, let us put those ideas together and make Seattle a beautiful place, an example for other cities to follow. That's what I'd like for us to do, to work together and really understand that we're all in this together. And sometimes people might not think that we're not all together just because some are doing better than others. You know, they might turn the other eye and say, well, it's not me. And also, when you see people on the streets, you know, they might be sleeping. But when we get too comfortable with just people that are sleeping, you know, a person actually could need some medical help or might be dead. I don't know. Or we don't know. So we have to care for people to make sure and be concerned about people versus just ignoring what's going on in Seattle. So again, I'm asking us to come together and let's care for one another. And that's just like it takes a village to raise a child. It takes a village. It takes all of us to make Seattle the beautiful city surrounded by water that it is.
Bobby Tucker would like your vote in the upcoming election for mayor of Seattle. Bobby, thanks for this time today.
Yes, I would like your friends and your enemies to vote for Bobby Tucker. I did.
Mayoral candidate Bobby Tucker, and you can hear all our previous interviews with the candidates by going to our website. You go to kuow.org/podcasts/the record. And in just a moment, you're going to meet author, illustrator Johnny Sun. You might know him from Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien or the Lin-Manuel Miranda book, Good Morning, Good Night. He's going to read to you from his new essay collection in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in to The Record today. You might have a little book reading time this summer, so here's an idea. I just read a new essay collection that is, it's a little glum for the usual beach read, but I liked his way with words. The author is Johnny Sun. He's best known for his picture book, Everyone's an Alien When You're an Alien, and for his illustrations for Lin-Manuel Miranda's Daily Affirmations book, Good Morning, Good Night. Sun's new essay collection is called Goodbye Again, and it has a theme of coming and going and never quite arriving, like the essay called Layover, when he's in an airport, he's just moved to a new city, which is not yet his home, so he's in no hurry to get there. He schedules a layover at an airport in between with no particular flight to catch, just so he can linger in that airport for as long as he wants.
There's a sense of comfort here in the airport precisely because you're not supposed to stay in an airport. The airport is not a destination. You're supposed to spend as little time in an airport as possible. I'm very familiar with this feeling that I'm not really welcome in a space. And this is a coldness that airports are at least open about. Airports make everyone feel like a passer-through, like a visitor, like an outsider. And this is comforting in its honesty because aren't we always just visitors, just passers-through? Most other places try to convince you that you are more than that. Airports don't dress it up. Because airports make you feel like you're always passing through, it also allows you to feel cut off from the world. While I'm here, I feel actively unreachable, protected by the fact that I am still in transit, still arriving, instead of simply being in the city and having no one in the city who would want to reach me. Here, I don't have to worry about feeling alone for a few moments longer. Feeling lonely is for people who have arrived somewhere, I tell myself, not for people still on the way there.
That's Johnny Sun reading from his new collection, Goodbye Again. So you'll never be in a lonely place as long as you don't get there?
Right. Maybe, yeah. I think there's a little bit of that sense of, I mean, I used this essay as a way to relate to the idea of like busyness and work too, where like I think the idea of like having constantly something to do or having somewhere constantly to go, whether that's like a physical place to go or sort of like a mental place to go, means that like there's never any time to sit. It feels like there's never a, it creates a way to never feel like you're just sitting there alone or like with your loneliness. Yeah.
You said something interesting in that essay you wrote. It's a very familiar feeling to you that you are not welcome in a place. Why is that?
I mean, I think a lot of it is tied to like the fact that I'm an Asian Canadian. There is that sort of stereotype of the perpetual outsider and of being sort of perpetually outsidered as a verb by a lot of the spaces that I've inhabited. Asian Americanness as an identity sort of exists in a strange liminal space, I think, in the sense that there is, I feel like I have a full understanding and a full sort of way to view myself and to view like other Asian American people that I love, but that sort of a gift, I guess, is something that sometimes isn't given to us by other people. And so like that sort of disparity creates a feeling of like, oh, I can walk into a space and sometimes feel like I'm not being seen fully the way that I see myself fully.
Yeah, I think I hear you internalizing that, like you really taking that on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if like, I think my fear too is I don't want to fully like exist to perpetuate that sort of identity or stereotype. But it really is, especially with this book, a sense of sort of like grappling and reckoning with a lot of those feelings and trying to think my way through it. Like with the book, I didn't really want to come to any conclusions in a way. Like I wanted to use the book both in writing it and for people who read it as almost like a tool of processing and a tool of sort of thinking things through.
There's another essay in this collection called Goodbye Again by Johnny Sun. Another essay picks up the theme of feeling alone or not having arrived yet. Would you mind reading the essay called Particles?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. This one, here it is. Particles. I think to get to the point where I can understand that I've changed, I have to dissociate from any past version of myself first. I have to treat those past versions of myself as outside of me, so I can see how I am different from those past selves. But when I dissociate my past from my present too cleanly, when I don't acknowledge that I am still in some way my past selves, I think that everything I've ever done has been done by a younger me who I no longer am, and everything I aspire to do needs to be done by an older me who I am not yet. And so present me is always doing, never having, and never achieving anything. Present me is the most useless version of myself. And I worry that I'll feel this way at every point in my life. What makes me feel a little better is telling myself that I am an older me to my past selves and a younger my future selves. And since present me is able to look at my past and future selves with some sort of admiration, that they are the ones who either have accomplished or will accomplish, it means that there are always people, my past selves and my future selves, who are looking at me like that too. Sometimes this adds pressure. I have to hold the expectations of not only myself, but all these other people now too. I'm not letting just myself down, but letting all these versions of myself down. But for the most part, it helps me to know that I have been and will be thought of with some sort of kindness when I can't muster that for myself right now. There are past versions of me who believe in me, and there are future versions of me who are looking back on where I am and thinking, that's the version of me who actually managed to achieve something. There are always these people cheering me on, or at the very least, thinking about me. And that helps me feel less alone, and that helps me feel like I am right where I need to be.
Johnny Sun, reading from his new essay collection, Goodbye Again. When I read that line, present me is the most useless version of myself, I laughed out loud. And the very next line, and I worry that I will always feel this way at every point in my life, or I sobered right up.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, because it does feel like that was sort of what I was trying to get to in that piece, and especially in those like in those two sentences. I feel like I would hope that that laugh was sort of like a laugh of recognition, and then there is that the sort of taking that and saying, well, this is actually something that I worry about, and we shouldn't just like sort of laugh off, or like I would like to spend more time with this.
I did relate to it when I was little, and my favorite song was on a Winnie the Pooh record. And it went halfway down the stairs is a stair where I sit. There isn't any other stair quite like it.
I'm not at the bottom. I'm not at the top. So this is the stair where I always stop.
And I would sit on the middle stair and think about that. And I've just, that idea of not arriving and maybe not wanting to be too solid somehow.
Yeah. I feel like that's a feeling that like I've felt my entire life, and that I feel like a lot of people feel, because I feel like we're in like a culture, or maybe like there's something about how I process the world that says like, oh, when you've finished something, you're just supposed to start again right away. Like there's never really an ending in any sense. It's sort of like we're just continually in motion and like perpetually kind of moving. And so I wanted to articulate kind of that feeling. And the middle stair is I love that image and that metaphor. It reminds me of I did a book with Lin-Manuel Miranda a couple years ago called Good Morning, Good Night. And I did the illustrations for it, and he did the text. And there was a passage about sort of that exact feeling that he had written about like new beginnings and endings and sort of never feeling like you really know where you are in those, in relation to those two things. And when I spoke to him about it to figure out the illustration, we started talking about fire escapes and like the idea that like in a fire escape along the side of a building, there are all these platforms where they always have, not all of them, but most of them have like a stair leading up and a stair leaning down. And the best you can do is feel like you're on a fire escape platform for a little bit before you have the choice to go up or down again. That like there's no permanent resting spot, but maybe at least you can sit on this little step for a little bit before you start to move again.
Johnny Sun, a graphic novelist, illustrator, Twitterer, screenwriter. His latest is called Goodbye Again, Essays, Reflections, and Illustrations. Johnny, I hope we get to meet in person one of these days. Yeah. Thank you for this time.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me, Bill. This is such a pleasure.
You're listening to KUOW's The Record.
Halfway down the stairs is a stair where I sit. There isn't any other stair quite like it. I'm not at the bottom. I'm not at the top. So these.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Appreciate you tuning in today. Did you know there used to be 17,000 varieties of apple in North American orchards? Most of those varieties are gone. They're extinct. We're pretty much left with Fuji, Braeburn, Granny Smith in the supermarket, a few others. But this is apple country. And there is a group here called the Lost Apple Project that is finding fruit that we thought was lost forever. They just found 7 more apple varieties dating back to the 1800s. Why is that important? Let's ask the founder of the Lost Apple Project, David Benscotter. Welcome to the show. David, good to have you with us today.
Well, it's great to be here, and thank you for letting me talk a little bit about the Lost Apple Project.
How did the project start?
It actually started back in, I guess it was about 2015, and I'd been looking here in eastern Washington for a couple of years, had found only the second known apple variety of one apple, and then in 2014, I found a Nero apple growing about 50 miles south of Spokane, and I could see that kind of on the horizon that that this area was, well, it's a little bit corny, but it's ripe for the picking. There were a lot of lost apples that were grown in eastern Washington and northern Idaho, and I approached the Whitman County Historical Society, and they accepted me as a project, and ever since we've been growing, and so far we've found 29 lost apple varieties.
But how did you first know you had found an apple that was a lost apple?
Well, I'll tell you, I I didn't know. I'm an absolutely terrible apple identification expert. I need to rely on others that can do this, and it's a very difficult job. It's a job that you have to learn from others, and there's actually only 5 apple identification experts that I know of in the United States. The two that I use are Joni Cooper and Sean Shepard of the Temperate Orchard Conservancy in Oregon. And they've been identifying apples for many years. And I found out that they did this and around the same time that I found out that there were actually lost apples that had been grown in Whitman County, Spokane County, Latah County, Idaho. And it was about that time I asked them if I could just send them some bags of apples, and they told me how to package the apples and how many they needed. And I sent them off, and every year we since 2017 we've found at least three apples.
Why is this important? Why are you and so many people working so hard to preserve apple varieties that were thought to be gone?
Well, you know, I do it because of the history involved in apples out west. The apple was just absolutely crucial to the homesteading of people out here in the Northwest. It was by far the most important fruit and maybe even the most important food a person could grow. The apple, eating fresh, you could have apples as early as July. And if you had keeper apples, kind that would keep over the winter well, you could put them in your cellar in October usually is when those would ripen. And some of them, like the Ben Davis apple, you could still eat fresh out of your cellar in April and May of the following year. And it was absolutely crucial for even having fresh fruit almost all year round. And plus, it was valuable for other reasons. You could dry it, you could can it, you could sauce it, you could make apple cider vinegar out of it. Of course, hard cider, we know, has alcohol in it, which can kill bacteria. And even the poor fruit, you could feed to your hogs or cows. And it was just an extremely important food for the settlers who came out west.
Well, I said we had 17,000 varieties in North American orchards. Why did we let all this diversity go?
Well, you know, it seems like it was around 1920 when we really started to see apples just drop off the edge of the world. It was around that time, and speaking about the United States, we're becoming more industrialized. You know, people were in the big cities. They weren't not growing their own apple trees. And out west here, I was able to get online and find a magazine for nursery owners. It was from 1918, where this nursery magazine told nursery owners, do not sell these certain varieties. They are not profitable anymore. And, you know, looking back on it now, we probably wish that hadn't happened, but right in that list were many, many lost varieties. And, you know, really, from a dollar and cents point of view, it probably was the right information to give to nursery owners.
Well, why were so many of these apples not profitable anymore? Did our tastes change, or what?
You know, I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, people wanting familiar apples. You know, it got to the peak probably in around the 1960s when you would go into a grocery store and there you could buy about four varieties of apples: Gold Delicious, Red Delicious, Granny Smith, and maybe one other apple. And actually in recent years we've kind of seen a changing picture with more apple introductions, kind of starting with the Honeycrisp. And it seems like and recently the Cosmic Crisp that WSU created. And there just seems to be more people wanting different flavors. And, you know, apples are amazing. You know, you can eat a tomato, and a tomato is kind of like a tomato, but an apple, every different apple tastes different and has a totally unique taste. There's even apples that taste like pears.
By the way, I just want to give a phone number to the tomato fans who are wondering, what number do I call to leave Bill Radke a voicemail about how different tomatoes are? So that's 206-221-3663. Right now, we're talking to David Benscotter, founder of the Lost Apple Project. You mentioned the changing tastes, and you mentioned the Honeycrisp and the Cosmic Crisp. It seems like apples today cannot be crisp enough. We so prize that. Why do you think that is?
Oh, you know, I'm not sure, but you know, certainly I think as important as crispness is to an apple, it all comes back to the flavor, and the flavor is what will cause a person to return to an apple again and again at the market and purchase it over and over again. And
so what are these older flavors, these you know, 1800s varieties, what did they taste like?
Oh my goodness. Every apple is different, and it's a lot of fun when I go through these old orchards, because I have to taste, you know, every apple tree, I'll taste its apples, and I just get surprised every time I taste an apple, a flavor that I've never tasted before. And, you know, some of the apples I can understand that, you know, they wouldn't have any long-term profitability at, like, grocery stores and things like that. One of them is the Kitagawski and even the Nero apple. Both of those are small apples, and the Kitagawski is, I would call it, well, politely, an ugly little apple, mm-hmm. but tastes absolutely incredible. Just wonderful flavor. And most of the apples that we find that have been lost are good tasting apples. There's a couple that we found that have been more historical than anything else, but all of them have been, you know, good apples, and I can understand why people would want them in their orchard.
Yeah, I'd eat a Kitagawski from how you describe it. David, we only have a couple minutes. Could you briefly describe how you find these trees and identify the apple varieties?
Well, what we the most general way we find them is people send me an email, and if you don't mind, I'll give my email address.
Sure.
It's dbens23@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at the Lost Apple Project. And people send me leads to apple trees. And if they're within my distance that I can drive a car to, I'll often go to these trees or orchards and pick apples. If people are a little bit outside my range, I might have them mail me the apples, and I'll take the important thing is I go out and pick them. I map the orchard. I give each tree GPS coordinates. I put those coordinates on a bag, label the bag, and I ship it off to our apple identification experts. And then they set to do their thing, and it's an incredibly difficult job. They use 150 old books and watercolor paintings from the late 1800s, early 1900s, and once in a while we get lucky.
We probably think of our apple industry as being in central Washington, but my guest, David Benscotter, finds apples across the inland Northwest. Apple varieties thought to be gone. Final question, David. Have you found that finding lost apples also brings people together?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think the greatest effect I see having on people is what it brings back memories. And the memories of maybe sitting in their mom's kitchen, tasting an apple that they hadn't tasted in 70 years. And it's wonderful to bring back those old memories.
David Benscotter, founder of the Lost Apple Project. It's been wonderful just to meet you and think bigger about, as we said, the usual suspects in the supermarket, and just to hear about your work. And again, David will wants to hear from you. Find the Lost Apple Project, and let's keep learning about our region. David, thank you so much for this time together.
You bet. Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Thanks for tuning in today. This show is produced by Jenny Cecil Moore, Alec Cowan, Brandy Fullwood, and Sarah Leibovitz. I'm Bill Radke, and let's get together again for The Record tomorrow on KUOW.